so I am here with Sarah Wendell and Candy Tan, who are the co-authors of Beyond Heaving Bosoms, and I understand you're also the finest comedy team since Hope and Crosby. Sarah and Candy, how are you doing?
Hope and Crosby?
I think.
What the crap are you talking about?
Exactly. What?
Let's start off with the very, very beginning here. Kathleen Woodwiss's The Flame and the Flower. This is the first single-title romance published in paperback. Were you, over the course of your research, able to discern why it took so long for this paperback first idea to hit romance as opposed to, say, science fiction or mystery? Why did it take so long? Do you have any specific speculation, facts? Go ahead. Let's start at the very beginning here.
Wait, why did what take so long to hit?
Oh, the Flame and the Flower.
I see.
Yeah. Actually, you know, like, we basically skipped over a whole lot of history because there were gothics that were precursors of romance novels, and Harlequin was doing its category title for a long time in paperback. And I think that we kind of picked Kathleen Woodwiss as sort of the start of what people think of as bodice rippers. And nowadays, people, especially in America, when they say romance novel, they pretty much think bodice ripper. You know, Fabio hair blowing in the breeze. People with aqua eyeshadow, you know, having their bodices, yea, verily, yanked away from them. And that, The Flame and the Flower, was probably the first that got really big. There were probably others in the past, but, yeah. So, I mean, like, romances have been published in paperback for a long time. This was just kind of, like, our somewhat arbitrary starting point. Because, we didn't have time to, like, cover every damn thing.
Yeah. So basically, The Flame and the Flower, that is your Gutenberg Bible.
Yes, if by Gutenberg Bible you mean a whole lot of raping. Yes.
Yes.
Well, I'm curious because science fiction, mystery, YA, these genres are getting respect, particularly in the last decade, and yet romance is still one of those things in which people thumb their noses down. Why do you think this is? Must we always have some place to go for the ghetto, or what's the deal here?
Well, I will point out that romance is actually getting a lot more respect because of the turgid strength of its quarterly earnings. And even though most industries, especially in New York, which is hyper navel-gazing in the financial industry, are experiencing massive losses year to year and quarterly to quarterly, romance is the one erect column in your spreadsheet. And remains quite strong. So while it doesn't get a lot of respect from your average cocktail crowd, most financial newspapers are having to pay attention to the strength of romance when you're looking at it as an investment or as an indicator of economy, which is why I think that Harlequin is sort of like chuckling or sort of befuddled at the entire economic crisis because they were founded during the Depression. I'm sure they're looking at this going, this is nothing. Are you kidding? Let me just tell you what it was really like.
This is great for business.
I know.
What the hell? No, I think personally that a lot of the reason why romance novels are the Rodney Dangerfield of genre fiction is the stigma of effeminacy. And it has to do with how, you know, like science fiction, oh, they're novels of ideas. You know, mysteries have lots of blood and guts. Well, some of them do. The ones that don't get respect, interestingly enough, tend to be the cozy mysteries. The ones in which, like, there's a cat solving the goddamn murder or whatever the hell. You know, those are the ones that are like, oh, man, you know, they're not worth taking seriously. The ones that, if I remember correctly, I might be wrong because I don't know mystery as well as I should. The hard-boiled mysteries were one of the first to kind of exit the ghetto. And
as long as there's arterial blood spray,
yeah,
you get some respect.
Or you know, I think
Spooge, not so much.
Yeah. I mean, there's definitely a lot more respect for male fantasies versus female fantasies in fiction. And you see this over and over again. So,
if we're going to talk about arterial blood spray, I think we should point out the fallacious anatomical scenario involving hymens, which you point out in this book.
At great length.
Yeah,
you can tell this is something that rubbed us the wrong way.
Yes, I
if anyone is listening, I want a complete pun count at the end of the podcast. And if we can like get an accurate pun number, I'll totally give away a copy of the book and some like buku prizes. If you can identify how many puns we make in the course of this interview.
I mean, but the question is you have so much attention to detail in historical romance, and yet this one thing continues to propagate continues to, I suppose, not be patched up in quite the way that one would expect.
Good one.
And so so what I'm wondering is do you think that romance readers and romance writers want to fantasize about where the hymen is? Is that really
I think it's simple oral history, and I don't mean that in a bad way. I think that the legend of the misplacement hymen is just something that's passed down from writer to writer, and much like the historical inaccuracies that plague other specific parts of the historical genre, where the hell your hymen is one of them.
Here's the thing. I think I've spotted the same misplacement of the hymen in other books, and not romance novels. Like, I think I've read a couple of horror novels where, you know, maybe it would have made sense if the girl being de-virginized were some kind of, you know, filthy alien beasts who, and by hymen we mean, like, vagina dentata, but we don't. Yeah. You know, and it's like, oh, look, it's infected other genres, too. How wonderful.
Yeah.
Anatomical, you know, craziness all the way around.
And that's not the only anatomical inaccuracy we've discovered. I mean, there's a few inaccuracies that are just mind-boggling. Like, there's one Galen Foley where the heroine, who's a bona fide virgin, and I mean bona fide, like, she's like, not only is she a virgin, but she's like a princess or some shit. They haven't even had sex yet. This is the first time they're kissing in the woods, and he tastes her milk. Because, you know, virgins spontaneously lactate, like a postpartum woman going into Target and hearing a baby cry. Yeah, same thing.
It was the most nipple-tacular moment in all of historical romance.
I had to stop reading. What? No, I cannot accept virgin lactation. I'm sorry. I draw the line. And everyone's line is different. Some people are okay with virgin lactation.
Yeah.
Some people are not. And that's okay.
Some people are okay with little homunculi living within somebody's testicular sac and then
exiting to... Individually sentient beings curled up underneath your scrotum to clean the love spunk. That's always a good thing.
But surely there's been romance that is... No, I'm totally with you on this. I mean, surely there's been one romance that actually did manage to get the hymen right. I mean, surely. There's been at least one. Someone finally got it right. I mean, this has to have been known. I mean, unless there's some sort of secret Hammurabi-like code that all romance authors sign in which you're not supposed to get it right.
Well, there's vague references of, gee, that hurt a little, wait, now it feels good. They usually are along the road to rightness. Most of the time, I actually have more respect for the writers, even in a historical, for whom the heroine's experience is, that was a little uncomfortable. But, you know, I ride horses a lot, and, you know, I'm on a farm. I climb stuff, so, okay, let's get to the nookie part. I refuse to believe that all of these hymens were ironclad and, you know, made of cast iron, and I also refuse to believe that these women were that ignorant of their bodies in the first place.
Yeah. I must point out that there are numerous points in the book. Sometimes the pun is intended, sometimes the pun is not. I'm wondering what ground rules you set for the pun being intended and the pun not being intended, because sometimes I thought it was intended, and then you would have a little footnote indicating that it was not, and I grew a little sad because I wanted it to be intended. So I'm curious about all this. I mean, was this an effort to confuse the reader or present another form of reading this book? I don't know. You tell me. I'm confused.
We wanted to keep you on your toes. It's a form of playing hard to get in a literary sense.
Yes.
We want you to keep coming back, and sometimes we don't.
Sometimes we yank it away cruelly.
That's right.
Well, on that vein, I noticed that the magic hoo-hoo is hyphenated on your website, but it is not hyphenated in your book, which leads me to wonder if there was some massive editorial struggle to, whether the hyphen exists or not. Can you tell me?
The hyphen or the hymen? Because what happened was that the hoo-hoo lost its hymen and at the same time lost its hyphen.
Yes, exactly. So
really
it
happened.
Seems to me you had hymen problems and hyphen problems.
Well, getting published sort of broke our cherry. We established some form of paper-based legitimacy, and we lost our hymen and our hyphen. It's all symbolic.
Honestly, I think that at some point the copy editor said, "You know, you guys sometimes hyphenate this and sometimes you don't. Pick one." And we went, "Okay, we'll remove it."
I'm sorry. In a book, you want consistency? Oh, well, we're on the internet. We don't know about that.
Screw spell check. Whatever.
You bring up a number of very valuable scholarly essays on romances. I'll start rattling a few of these off. Lilith Sancroix in her essay, "Half of Humanity is Worth Less Than a Chair."
She rocks.
Points to the problem of the wandering vagina. Old attitudes.
Oh, God, there goes one now.
Yeah, exactly.
It's going down to Dyke's Lumber, conveniently located three doors down from where we
are
right now.
That's right, yes. We are away from close to Dyke's want... Yeah, anyway. Old attitudes about the lack of vaginal ownership have been known to crop up in the new school books because the heroine might sire a bastard son. But the idea that St. Croix promulgates is that a woman reclaims her sexuality through the hero and in so doing finds a vaginal home. But I'm still not sure how the vaginal issue, the wandering vaginal issue, is in fact resolved. Because if the woman is relying on a man to reclaim her identity, is this not as bad as the rapists in the old school romances? I'm a little sort of concerned here. How do you corral the fantastical elements with the sort of we live in the 21st century idea?
Well, I think part of it is the element of choice. Like, we're now bestowing our delicate flower upon the quivering tower of manhoods and not having our flower brutally plucked away, so to speak. So that I think is a key difference. And in terms of the vagina finding a home, I think in the more modern romances, it's more about building community and family and friendship and finding a place where you belong. And because it's a romance novel, you know, incidentally, it's romantic love. And because most of us are heterosexual women and we like reading about heterosexual fantasies, although, you know, the gay romance and the you know, poinking of the two swords together. It's such a pity you can't see the little hand gesture I'm doing over the internet. But anyways, that's also becoming more and more popular. But the fact is that I think that romances are about finding stability and love and belonging. And that's where the vagina finds a home comes in, but there's less of the explicit, you are now my woman and my property, that you used to see in older romance novels.
If you think about it, in a lot of ways, the romance genre mimics in its development of the character arcs of the hero and heroine the changes in matrimonial contract. For example, you know, back in the day, because, you know, I'm such a historical scholar, days of yore, for example, the heroine would move from her father's protection to her husband's protection, and that was a very real and necessary thing on a personal and a financial and a social level. You needed to be within the shelter and home of someone else. Now, within a contemporary romance, and I don't mean romances set in the present day, but romances written right now, both the hero and the heroine not only have to experience their own arc of development, but they have to agree simultaneously to choose one another. And that is the same thing that's negotiated in the civil unions in this country, where both people are choosing one another. Nobody gave me away, for example, at my wedding. And well, since I'm Jewish, I actually have a contract saying what my husband has to do for me. I think he, like, shut up. That is so not cool.
This
don't block the
all
box,
the time on
jackass.
This program. I'm sorry.
Also, it's a douche nozzle in a Mercedes picking up like a crowd of people who couldn't possibly have missed him because his car is as big as the sun. Anyway, not that I'm bitter. So you have a man and a woman.
Scrotal son.
Yeah, I'll tell you how I really feel. You know, the wheelbase of your car is inversely proportionate to the length of your penis. Totally true story. So you have the hero and the heroine agreeing to be with one another. And so it's not only that your vag finds a home, but his wang also finds a steady location of monogamy. It is a mutual choosing, and that's a marked difference between the wandering vagina that needed to be, you know, claimed as violently as possible.
So home is where the heart is, or home is where the wang is?
One would hope both.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, have you met contemporary marriage? Sex is good.
Yeah. Actually,
we make no bones about that.
Just keep them coming. Keep them coming. I actually wanted to raise a very interesting question.
Raise? Yes, good idea.
Now raise, yes. You point out that sex in romance novels has accelerated, propagated, so to speak, to the point where oral sex is now vanilla, commonplace, and the like. This is interesting to me because if we look at pornography, we have seen increasing sex and the like. I'm curious if you both think that there is a limit to how far romance genre can go before you get into a kind of this, the hard line between erotic and romance begins to dissolve in some sense, or is this division overstated?
Sarah and I were just talking about this the other day. We were talking about how anal is the new oral, and you know, back in the day, oral sex was just woo, oh my god, they have oral sex in a romance novel. And nowadays, if it's not in, you're like, man, what a shitty lover. What was the hero thinking, man? And definitely in more and more mainstream romance novels, you're seeing anal sex sort of come into play. And you don't see the really exotic stuff until you get into erotica, especially like paranormal erotic romance and paranormal erotica. And that's when you get stuff like heroes with hemipenis that house...
For the uninitiated, that would be multiple wangs.
Double the pleasure, double the fun, double penetration all the time. And the, you know, a little homunculus that lives in the testicular sac that comes out and cleans out the channels, so to speak. So everything's, you know, sparkly for the next invasion. Yeah, that stuff you won't see in mainstream romance novels yet. But I really do think that it's going to be, it's just a matter of time before you start seeing some of the more exotic flavors of sex kind of enter into the mainstream. They may not be as explicit, they may not be as crucially part of the story, but I really do see that as people are more comfortable with exploring alternative sexuality scenarios, that you'll see more and more of that.
The other thing that's interesting is that you see a more variety in the sexual attitude of the heroine. For example, Victoria Dahl's Talk Me Down, the heroine is a erotica writer, not even erotic romance, erotica writer, and completely upfront about the fact that she has massive horny pants for the hero and has fantasized about him since she was a teenager. And a couple of mainstream romance review magazines called her a dog in heat and had a very big problem with the fact that she was, for all intents and purposes, sexually aggressive and completely in tune with the fact that she had horny pants. Now, most women have horny pants. Sometimes it actually says on our underpants, horny pants, or the days of the week, or both, whatever. But it is now, I think, more acceptable for a heroine in a romance to be exceptionally upfront with the fact that she want hot dick now. Please. Maybe not even please. We don't have to be nice. So because you have this changing attitude towards female sexuality, that is going to continue to develop. I don't know how much more exotic we could get in terms of sexual practice. I mean, there's a whole lot of tentacle sex scenarios that I think probably could be explored, but I don't necessarily want to read them or explore them myself. In terms of sexual attitude, there's a whole lot more to be done. There's a lot of growth potential.
It's a high growth industry. But going back to your question here about more alternative forms of sexuality that Candy cites, and what Sarah identifies as the increasing sort of I want it now quality among the heroines, again, it sort of goes back to the point about what is romance and what is erotica. This troubling confusion that those who aren't familiar with romance often confuse the two. But if we're going to go ahead and see Bukowski-themed romance novels or something, then suddenly the lines do start to blur. So maybe perhaps you're seeing a potential uniting here in the next 10 years among romance readers and erotica readers, or there's people, they could trade narrative tips from each other, or what's the deal?
I don't think so, because the core element of a romance is that there has to be a happy ending for the protagonist, and the protagonist could be more than two. You could have a polyamorous happy ending that has been done and done with some success. You have to have a happy ending and an emotional conclusion to the storyline in addition to all the hot funky monkey sex. So if all you have is hot funky monkey sex, but there's no growth or thank you, or I get water, or even an emotional arc, or any personal growth on the part of either character, it's not a romance necessarily. The happy ending is key, and not every erotic story has that.
And not only that, but you know, romance novels focus on the romance, the growing relationship between the hero and heroine, and part of that relationship is mediated through sex. I mean, it's a really popular and really easy way to show that he's the one. You know, the orgasms are bigger and better and brighter and wetter and et cetera than with anybody else. Whereas erotica is basically kind of like a more no-holds-barred exploration of sexuality, and love doesn't even have to enter into it, much less any kind of sex. So I do see them as being really separate, even as, you know, sex scenes get more explicit. And certainly I think they both genres have a lot to learn from each other. And, you know, the lines of communication should remain open, so to speak. But
it seems to me that if we are talking about potential genre fusion in the next 10 years, this hypothetical idea, that maybe we could see erotica with a happy ending that might in fact be categorized under the romance genre, or are they too delineated in their forms so that they can't converge?
I mean, maybe. Well, I think that already exists because erotic romance is one of the fastest growing profitable subgenres. It has an economic and fan-based strength that I don't even think fusion is necessary. Erotica as a literary form has one audience, and that may have some overlap with erotic romance, but it's two different audiences. And I don't think there needs to be so much fusion between those two genres as there needs to be an understanding that one isn't more or less valid than the other. Because erotica has always been slightly more acceptable. You know, it gets a very tasteful black and white photography cover, maybe, you know, the side of a breast and, you know, some possibly a nipple. And erotic romance has been unfortunately saddled with an awful lot of poser man titty. And it's really easy to weep for the sadness that is a man afflicted with poser man titty. It makes the genre look bad because poser man titty looks like crap.
And, you know, you're speaking, going back to your earlier question about why, you know, romance novels have remained in the genre ghetto. I firmly believe that the covers have a lot to do with it. And, it you know, the publishers are kind of between a rock and a hard place because on one hand, they say that clinch covers sell. They sell harder and faster than any other kind of cover that they slap on the books. And on the other hand, they get really, really vocal reactions against them. And it's hard. I think, in my opinion, that clinch covers have become kind of like this easy, eye-catching way to signify, like, hey, here's a romance novel. Do not be led astray.
Particularly considering that the major shopping audience of romance is women. And
at grocery stores, usually. Like,
and
at the
we don't
line.
Have a lot of time to be grabbing a book. If I tried to go leisurely book shopping with my kids, there'd be mutiny. Yeah. Unless that Barnes & Noble has a really good train table, I'm screwed. I got to shop quick and run.
Yeah. And you know, but I do firmly believe that, you know, just, I mean, I feel such embarrassment squick for the covers. And I don't think I'm the only one. And it often conveys a completely wrong impression about what's inside the book. You open it and you expect all kinds of lurid, titillating stuff. And sometimes it's just like really sweet, really, you know, like slow-moving romance, and it, absolutely, the covers have nothing to do with what's inside, so.
But now covers are getting a lot better. There are some covers coming out this summer and this fall that are just exquisite, that communicate, this is a romance, but don't do it with a woman with absolutely astonishing mammary glands and a guy who looks like he's either just had a lobotomy or is having a very painful attack of waterwood. You're moving away from the bad clinch, and it's possible to do a couple standing together without making it salaciously ridiculous.
Yeah, I think a rule of thumb here is if the hero and heroine on the cover look like they're about to compete for most Aquanet in hair of all time, you know, that's a bad cover.
Have you really managed to get, speaking of the covers, the hair situation and the shirts that are unbuttoned but tucked in? I mean, this seems to be something that's not going to go away anytime soon. I mean, I would like to see a bald badass, just speaking from a sort of regrettably self-interested standpoint, on the cover of one of these romances.
And, sadly, you will see more women of size. I don't think men of any physique other than exceptionally muscular will be pictured, which is odd because there's many books out there right now who have mega whopping muscular, like, road tread speed bump man, you know, man titty, and then a whole set of, like, you know, washboard abs, and then you read the book and the hero is very thin, nondescript, tends to blend in, nobody notices him, and it's a complete disconnect between what the hero actually looks like and what's portrayed on the cover. I don't think that balding men of any other body type will be pictured. I do think they'll be included because, I mean, let's be honest, there are some bald guys that are damn hot. Even if it's Jim Cantore on the Weather Channel, somebody totally has some slash fic about him. And
Jean-Luc Picard, come on. Oh. You know, Patrick Stewart. Patrick Stewart and Ian McKellen / Legion on the internet. I mean,
bald guys are not bad. Bald guys are hot. And they won't be pictured on the romance novel, but they will definitely be inside a romance novel at one point soon.
Maybe there needs to be a special code on the cover, like a little sort of icons indicating that, okay, well, we can't actually show a bald man in the depiction of the cover
this
or any other sort of thing.
This novel is brought to you by the Hair Club for Men.
I also wanted to bring up the prisoner's dilemma scenario that you introduce in this book, where, Sarah, you, 90% of the sex scenes in books that you read are from the point of view of the heroine.
Whereas
Candy, you equate that 90% to the old school romances, and it's 50-50 down the middle between men and the hero and the heroine. So what accounts for this discrepancy? Is there a game theory scenario that could work this out? Or maybe you could explain the difference here about your respective reading choices. Or is it largely as serendipitous as Sarah has implied with this, you know, basically a drive-by shopping scenario at Barnes & Noble?
But we both have very different tastes in romance novels, and so what I like is not what Candy likes, which is actually what makes the review collective more diverse. I read different romance novels. I'm much more of a contemporary and historical romance fan. I'm not so much into paranormal. I don't stray into fantasy all that much, and I tend to stay within my genres much of the time. Candy has a much different reading taste than I do, so our experience in what the hero and heroine are doing come from two different perspectives. But I'm also happy to admit, well, maybe I'm not right.
You know, it's not like I kept any kind of strict track of, you know, what I'm reading. I was basically speaking from like, well, you know, this is like my general impression from what I've read. And yeah, and we do read very, very different books. I mean, like, we have a decent amount of overlap. We've both read a decent amount of, like, the really big names, like Lisa Kleypas and Jennifer Cruzy, names like those. But yeah, and when it comes down to it, we read different books and might be remembering different things. So who the hell knows? It might be really interesting, though, to do some kind of quantitative study. I would be really, really interested if somebody wanted to take the time to do that. That'd be pretty sweet.
But what about the pirate fixation you have? I mean, this is a very big dilemma in the light of the fact that the happy-go-lucky twee factory of McSweeney's has pirate shops, and I don't think that these pirate shops can possibly convey the pirates who were rapists and grimy, scummy individuals.
They smelled, too.
Yeah.
Oh God. I mean, like, for me, the pirate romance is basically, you know, I'm not necessarily in love with pirates in and of themselves, but just the idea of the constant danger the heroine is in, the fact that she's probably imprisoned, and how the hero has to battle with essentially the devil and the angel on his shoulders. Plus, you know, there's the whole cross-dressing factor, which is really super fun if the heroine is, you know, a cabin boy and the hero suddenly feeling ambiguous about his sexuality. I love that. I love cross-dressing romances for precisely that reason. And I don't know, like, there's just, like, so much more traveling in pirate romances. You're not stuck in Regency England all the motherfucking time. Oh, my God. And you're actually traveling to the Barbados or something. So, yeah, that's the... It's very much a fantasy for me. I am not in any way taking my pirate romances seriously and going, oh my God, this is so accurate, you know?
Let's talk about The Big Miss, which you bring up as the most regrettable cliche in romances. I should point out that the drink that is thrown into Julian English's drink in Appointment in Samara is a big miss, and yet it works fine for Appointment in Samara, yet it doesn't work quite so well for romance. Why do you think that is?
Well, some of the best romances written were founded on the basic big misunderstanding premise. Bet Me starts out with basically a misunderstanding, and the hero and heroine call each other on it. That happens regularly. The problem with the big misunderstanding in romance is that it is a crutch for an additional 100 to 200 pages when employed badly. If you'd get these idiots in a room together for 5 minutes, they could work out the problem. But because it's much more interesting for them to have a really petty, stupid, and completely unnecessary disagreement to extend the romantic tension for another little while, gives the author time to wrap up all those pesky subplots and, you know, increase the page count by a good couple hundred pages. And when you see it used that way, it's immensely unsatisfying. Because how in the world are you going to believe in the happy ending of these two morons who can't even resolve a really stupid argument?
And I think part of it is also whether the misunderstanding is rooted in something really believable. Like, you know, is the big misunderstanding rooted in some kind of character flaw, say the hero's really hot-tempered and it, you know, is quick to fly off the handle. If that's shown to be consistently true, and you know, that makes a big misunderstanding maybe a little bit more understandable in terms of like it being perpetuated. But then of course you run up against the problem of, well, should the heroine be falling in love with an asshole, you know, who loses his shit over every little goddamn thing? Maybe not. But you know, like, it can be done well when the writer sets it up in such a way that it's a natural outgrowth of circumstances and personalities versus, oh God,
Well, you're mean.
Yeah.
You're a whore.
Exactly.
Well, you're mean.
Yeah, we need to feel more conflict.
Wow, that was satisfying.
Yeah, exactly.
But you're also talking about romances where simultaneous orgasm happens all the time.
Yes.
And of course, going back to our hymen concern,
yes,
that we had initiated earlier, it seems to me that a big miss would be the least of the worries in a romance when there are these other perpetuating circumstances.
Well, I don't know if simultaneous orgasms are something you need to really worry about. If they're happening, good for you. I just wish they wouldn't happen so often, because it's completely misleading for, you know, mere mortals.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I have talked to people who read romance novels when they were younger and went into sex kind of expecting simultaneous orgasms and going, wait, what the hell, dudes? I have been shortchanged. And that's kind of a shame that people, you know, sometimes come away from these books with unrealistic expectations, especially if they're young and kind of impressionable. So,
this theory that romances tend to operate or flourish best during a Republican presidency. We're now in a Democratic presidency, and so I'm wondering if this will cause a problem for the flourishing and the sort of forbidden fruit of romance novels in the future.
Have you seen the economy? It's kind of flaccid. Romance is going to be fine. Doesn't matter who's in office. If the economy's in the shitter, romance will do just fine.
Yep. When it comes down to it, I think that romances offer an escape, and they offer a chance to take a vacation in the most pleasant way imaginable, and for only $6.99. So, I don't think the presidency is going to have anything to do with how well it does.
But with the Cassie Edwards scenario, you two got into serious trouble for not playing nice. And so you go into, at some length in the book, this problem in the romance community of people not being critical of romances so that they can, in fact, develop. So, if we are talking about a type of book that is a fantasy that is also unable to be criticized without someone getting criticized further and the criticizing perpetuating till the end of time because the internet will do that, how then can one provide some grounding to keep romance evolving and to keep romance happening and merging and propagating and the like?
I think having open, honest discussions is key, and just keeping the lines open and ignoring the flame wars and just trying to keep a reasonable, calm voice out there while at the same time not putting up with any shit. Like, if you are, you know, if there is righteous indignation, to let that voice be true, but also not to fly off the handle, or at least, you know, try hard not to fly off the handle.
I did a presentation to the Washington Romance Writers with Nora Roberts, and the title was Plagiarism: If We Don't Talk About It, It Won't Go Away. No matter how many times a plagiarism scandal occurs in any genre, not just romance, the responses are almost identical every goddamn time. There's somebody who will excuse the person who copied because they are of such reputation, and they'll say that the person who was copied should be flattered. Because imitation is, after all, the sincerest form of flattery, or, you know, in my world, imitation is the quickest way to get my boot up your ass. There's the standard hand-wringing and navel-gazing and questioning of how hard you should come down about plagiarism. Will it hurt you as a writer to stand up and say another writer done wrong? That happens every stupid fucking time. And until we keep having the conversation enough that it changes, it won't change. And I don't give a flying rat's ass what anyone says about us for having exposed plagiarism in Cassie Edwards' books. It was there. I don't understand why what we said or how we said it or who we are is even an issue. How is it such a hard thing to say that plagiarism is wrong? This completely befuddles me. Yet it still happens. And it happens on an alarmingly regular basis in publishing. And the response is so stupidly identical. It's almost comedy, except that it still makes me angry and tends to raise my blood pressure.
And it was complicated by the fact that we had reviewed her books very poorly in the past, so people thought we had an axe to grind. But it was just so strange to me, because what we had were objectively verifiable facts. You could open up this book to this page, and you could get a copy of the book we were referencing, and you could check it up for yourself, word for word, what we were talking about. I don't see how, just because of the fact that, you know, like that we had reviewed her books poorly, somehow made our findings suspect. And honestly, if I had come across a similar thing on one of my favorite authors, I would have been even more pissed off. I would have been even more angry, because the feeling of betrayal would have been so much more severe. And it wasn't there in this case. I was just kind of befuddled, like, oh my God, how long has this been going on? You know, the people basically read into the whole scandal as Sarah and I having some kind of crazy vendetta and wanting to bring her down by like any means possible, which was really...
time for a vendetta.
I know, it was really strange. I was just thinking, you know, I wish I had the time to and
mount,
the energy.
Mount a vendetta.
Yeah, exactly.
Sounds kind of sexy.
Or even consider it. But I guess it makes it easier to swallow that we're two, you know, these two horrible whores who had an axe to grind, and this was why, you know, there's somebody beloved to her fans, you know, why she was brought down.
One thing that came out of the entire experience is that I've learned never, ever presume to know the motivation of why somebody said something. 9 times out of 10, you're wrong. So more than anything on the internet, it has taught me the lesson that I have to work with what is being said and not why I think it was said, because I'm probably incorrect. So if that was the charge that was leveled against me, that I had some nefarious motivation in doing this, well, I didn't. And I know better now to have a lot more patience with other people on the internet.
How do you manage to get this open-minded and more almost journalistic attitude conveyed and practiced throughout the romance community to get them sort of saying, look, I don't have an axe to grind, this is just simply wrong, this is an ethical debate, this is a conversation that we need to have?
Some people are very comfortable doing that, and most of the time they wear skirts because their balls don't fit in their pants. And these are women writers who will say, I don't give a fuck, this is wrong. And there are a lot of people who are frightened of making a bad name for themselves in an internet kerfuffle like that, who are worried that it's going to hurt their profits, who are worried about the status of their careers. And it is very hard to argue with someone who is worried about their way of earning a living that they should take an ethical stand on something because you think so. I can control exactly what I do. I don't have control over anything else.
I think part of it also is the fact that some of the authors, the fact that plagiarism is wrong is so glaringly obvious that they don't feel like anything needs to be said. It's like saying, hey, murdering babies is wrong. And they're like, well, just because I don't blare it to everyone doesn't mean I think it's right. It just means that, hey, dipshit, it's so wrong, we don't really need to point it out to you. Which isn't, that's a legitimate stance. I mean, like, I know that I've had a couple of instances where somebody was talking about something and I'm like, are you seriously even contemplating, like, that this might in any universe be okay? Like, what's wrong with you? You know, like, something that just runs against the grain so strongly that it's basically an implicit assumption. You know, it's just part of the operating mode. And, but I think that these people are in the minority. And it's good to have this conversation whenever it crops up. Although I certainly do not make the assumption that, you know, just because somebody doesn't want to talk about it means that they somehow think it's okay. But it's good to have their voices added to the conversation, you know? Like, hey, if it's part of your implicit worldview, why not talk about it?
Sarah, Candy, thanks very much. It was a pleasure to chat with you. Thanks for taking the time out.
Thank you for interviewing us.
Thank you. You are way, way better than us.
Get it wrong, it's all right. million other drunken white folks ever ready with their banknotes. You must have never met my wife though.